Okay, we'll move on now to talk about the Antigone. Well, the action of the Antigone takes its cue from the quarrel between Eteocles and Polynices, who are sons of Oedipus and who have fought over the throne of Thebes. Both of them are killed, but Eteocles was killed defending Thebes, while Polynices was the aggressor. And so Creon, who succeeds to the throne, decides to honour Eteocles' patriotism and make an example of Polynices' treason. And the play begins with a dialogue between Antigone and Ismene, daughters of Oedipus, in which Antigone communicates to Ismene Creon's refusal to allow the burial of Polynices and his edict condemning anyone to death who contravenes that decision. Eteocles, by contrast, is to be buried in state. And in the opening scene, Antigone resolves to bury her dishonoured brother and accept the consequent penalty, the death penalty. Well, so far, I think most people would agree with that summary, but as soon as you try to go beyond it, you immediately end up in controversy, and just about every aspect of this play is controversial if one tries to say anything of a general and theoretical nature about what the play is saying, what it's supposed to show, who, if anyone, is in the right, who is in the wrong. As soon as one starts to address these questions, one immediately finds oneself in deep controversy, and very different views of the play have been defended passionately by different commentators. What I'll give you here, as I give you in my lecture notes, is my own take on the play. So I'll just put up front that this is my reading of it. This is how I think it should be understood. But that is, I emphasise, just one reading, and there are lots of others out there, and you need to look at the evidence and make up your own minds about what the play means. But I enter that caveat at the beginning. I won't keep putting it in every time I make a claim, so I will make my case fairly polemically on the understanding that you need to look at the evidence and think about it for yourself and treat my interpretation with a pinch of salt, compare it, contrast it with other interpretations, and make your own minds up about who has the right of it. So the first move that I'll make, which, and very little of what I'll say is original to me, you can find most of the points that I'll make somewhere or other, not always in the same critic, but most of the moves that I'm going to make are ones that have been made at some stage or other by some critic. So the first move I make is to agree with those who say that in issuing his edict at the beginning of the play, Creon, as ruler of Thebes, is within his rights, and I note that he is initially supported by the chorus. So he is within his rights to deny burial to Polynices. That is because Polynices attacked his native city. He wanted to seize the throne back from Eteocles. Now, it may be that Eteocles did him an injustice in excluding him from Thebes. That's part of the background of the story. But Polynices assembled a foreign army and invaded his native land. And that in itself is an act of treason, and I think would have been regarded as such by Sophocles' Athenian audience. And when we identify Polynices as a traitor, quite a lot follows from that. And one thing that follows, I think, is that Creon is, as I say, within his rights to deny him burial. Because denial of burial to traitors was standard practice in ancient Greece. I say it was standard practice, that doesn't mean that it was followed exceptionlessly or that it couldn't be questioned or anything like that. And indeed, it is questioned in an earlier play by Sophocles, the Ajax, Ajax commits an act of treachery against the Greek leaders in that play. But Odysseus, although he was one of the people whom Ajax tried to kill, pleads for and secures Ajax's burial against the judgments of Agamemnon and Menelaus, who don't want him buried because of his treason. But Odysseus, as I say, pleads for and secures Ajax's burial despite the latter's treachery. So that the fact that exposing the body of traitors was standard practice doesn't mean that there could be no exceptions to it, and that a humane attitude, what we would regard nowadays as a more humane attitude, was out of the question. The Ajax shows that that's not so. However, the starting point that I have is that I'm not saying that Creon selected the best possible course of action, the most humane possible course of action. It's a more reserved claim than that, which is that he is simply within his rights to issue the edict that he does as ruler of Thebes, and given that Polynices was a traitor. Now, some people have pointed out that strict Athenian law, which is how Sophocles' audience might well have been thinking, the terms in which they might well have been thinking, it seems that it forbade the burial of traitors only within Attic territory, so only within Athenian territory, not outside it. And Creon, of course, issues a quite general ban on Polynices' burial. He doesn't follow the practice of casting the body outside the bounds of Thebes, which was one strategy that was followed, and then it was left to the deceased's relatives to bury the body in an external location. So long as they didn't try to bring it back within the territory of the city-state, then a blind eye was turned to the fact that they were burying the body. And you might say, and some critics have said, well, Creon should have issued a more restricted ban, saying, well, nobody is allowed to bury Polynices within Theban territory, but if Antigone or anyone else wishes to take his body outside Theban territory and bury it there, then that's up to them. He doesn't do that, and so some critics have thought that he's imposing an excessive penalty in issuing a general ban on the burial of Polynices anywhere. There's no concession made that burial in some places might be acceptable, whereas burial in other places not. It's a general ban on his burial. However, nothing is made of this point in the play. Nobody mentions it. And it seems to me one of those cases where the fact that it's not at all mentioned by anyone suggests that it's not really relevant. And that's quite a subtle point. If we're really supposed to think that Creon might well have issued something like his edict, but not exactly the edict he did issue, then it seems to me that's something that, if we were supposed to think that, should be said by one of the characters, particularly by the chorus. It would be the role of the chorus. But Antigone could have said it as well. Tiresias could have said it. There are several people who could say it in the course of the play. And that would give us an indication that we were supposed to think that the edict that Creon issued went too far. But it's not said, and it seems to me that we're not supposed to think that. We're not supposed to think in those rather more subtle terms. Sophocles is, if you like, wanting to keep the issue as simple as he can. And so he's working with a general ban on Polynices' burial. And as I say, I think in issuing his edict at the beginning of the play against that burial, Creon is at least within his rights. But, having said that, it does of course become clear during the play that Creon's position, even if it started off as being justifiable, becomes much less justifiable as the play progresses, and in particular in the Tiresias scene. There it becomes clear that Creon should reverse his ban. He should indeed have done so at an earlier stage, and his stubborn persistence in upholding the ban is a mistake on his part. And it seems that that is a classic Aristotelian case of hamartia. He goes too far in upholding the ban as long as he does. Now, he attempts to justify his intransigence, and his justifications are not in themselves unreasonable in the sense that the city of Thebes has just been engaged in a war, which, although it involved a foreign invader, was also to some extent a civil war, because Polynices was one of their own, and will have had supporters within the city. So that Creon's position is precarious. He's a new ruler, he's inherited the throne after a quasi-civil war, and naturally he's nervous and worried about possible rebellions. So he feels he has to issue a very strict ban. He has to lay down the law and show no sign of weakness. He feels that if he shows any signs of weakness, he will expose himself to rebellion. So it's understandable that he should proceed as he does, but it nevertheless, I think, becomes clear during the course of the play that it is a mistake, or that it becomes a mistake, to persist with the ban. And an indication of that is the way he tends to associate the state with himself, tends to identify, rather, the state with himself. He adopts the posture of a tyrant in some of his utterances, and it's clear that he is thinking of the city as his own property to do what he likes with and to say what he likes about, so that he's adopting a kind of papal infallibility stance, I can do no wrong. And since that clearly goes too far, it seems that the point of putting that kind of language into his mouth is to indicate that he is becoming guilty of hubris, of overweening pride. He's taking his authority too far. And another aspect of that, I think, although again this is, like many of the points I'm making, controversial, is that I think he misinterprets the nature of the threat posed by Antigone, and indeed Ismene. He thinks of them as representing some kind of political threat, a threat to his throne, as trying to subvert his rule. So he thinks of them as some kind of front for a rebellion which has got players in the background who are using them as pawns and will at an appropriate moment strike. And so he feels he's got to be firm with Antigone and Ismene in order, as we would say nowadays, to send a message to the people he thinks who are behind her, who are manipulating her. That's basically how he sees the situation. And this is a mistake. This is a miscalculation on his part. He should realise that Antigone isn't acting on anyone else's behalf. She's acting entirely on her own behalf. And this is a crucial point, which I'm going to say a lot more about, and again is controversial. Her motives are not political. They're not even really religious. They're personal. And he fails to see this, and if he had seen it, he would have regarded her resistance to his edict as much less of a threat to his rule. It's not really a threat at all, and he fails to see that. And that, I think, is his underlying cognitive failure in the play, a mistaking of the nature of Antigone's resistance. Now, as I say, in saying that, I'm entering these controversial waters because a lot of people have interpreted the play in a purely political way. Antigone as a political dissident, if you like, somebody resisting tyrannical oppression, that's been a common way of reading the play. So that many critics have gone along with Creon's own understanding of her as a political subversive, and therefore somebody who needs to be crushed. That's how Creon thinks of her, and a lot of critics have in effect agreed with that, and I'm saying that's a mistake. My view is that she's not acting politically at all, not politically in the sense of state politics, high politics. Of course, there's a sense, as we know, in which the personal is political, as people say, so that even if somebody has purely personal motives, there's a sense of the word political in which that also counts as political, because Antigone is engaging in some kind of power struggle with Creon. Both of them want to win it. That is, of course, in a broad sense of the word, a political contest, but it's not a political contest in the sense of high politics, state politics. She's not attempting to overthrow his rule and supplant him as ruler, and that is what he fears. So it seems to me that Creon wrongly politicizes Antigone's act of burying her brother, and so overestimates its danger to him personally as ruler and to the state of Thebes coming out of a quasi-civil war. Her act, although it contravenes the edict, and if other people had undertaken it, Creon might well have been right to suspect deep subversion. In her case, it doesn't mean that. It means something much more anodyne, something to which he could take a much softer line, to which he could afford to take a much softer line. And while we're on the subject of Creon, before we get on to Antigone herself, because I've said that Creon commits a hamartia, broadly speaking, of a cognitive nature, so he is, I think, a tragic figure in the play. The play has more than one tragic figure, and there's more than one hamartia, I think. And Creon, of course, I mean, apart from anything else, he has much the largest part in the play. Antigone disappears halfway through the drama, but Creon is there right to the end, and he survives. And he has a great deal to say in the play. As I say, he's the largest part, so that in a way he is, I don't know whether we'd want to say he was the most important figure. The play is, after all, not named after him. It's named after Antigone. But he's certainly a very important figure in the play, and he is of tragic stature, I think, and he does follow the Aristotelian pattern of sin followed by punishment, hamartia followed by catastrophe. And I'm saying that the nature of his mistake is basically cognitive, a misunderstanding of Antigone's resistance to his edict. That, combined with his tendency to act the tyrant, and you might say that's a flaw of character on his part, produces his intransigence. And another aspect of his cognitive failure in the play, which comes out very clearly in the second half, this is why one reason why the second half is so important, is that he misunderstands himself. He underestimates the extent to which personal relations are in fact important to him. He identifies himself too closely with his role as ruler of Thebes. He thinks of himself as simply a ruler, and he thinks of the domestic as unimportant, trivial. He doesn't want it interfering with high political matters. This comes out particularly in his scene with his son, Haemon, who tries to persuade Creon to reverse his edict. And Creon is quite happy to persist in his intransigence, even at the cost of breaking off relations with his son, and of course in due course losing his son's life. At this stage of the drama, he doesn't appreciate that actually matters to him. He thinks it doesn't matter. He thinks if Antigone, who is a relative of his, of course, a niece, he thinks that if she wants to contravene the edict and get herself punished by death, well, so be it. Why should he care? And he doesn't care about his meanie either. And it seems he doesn't care about Haemon. And he discovers too late, particularly when his wife Eurydice takes her own life, that he does in fact care about all of these people. He is much more personal, much more domestic than he realized. Social relations, familial relations, domestic relations are actually much more important to him than he'd realized. And he misidentified his own nature. He thought of himself, if you like, as a purely political animal, only interested in high matters of state policy, not interested in domestic affairs. And that is a mistake. It's a mistaken reading of his own character. I mean, not only is it a mistake, Sophocles is saying, to try to be somebody like that, it's also a mistake in Creon's own case, in the sense that he actually really isn't like that. He's falsifying his own nature. He's acting against his own deepest desires, which are much more normal, if you like, much more domestic, much more personal than he realizes. Like everyone else, he does, in fact, care about his immediate family. And so in taking action that leads to the death of those around him, he goes too far in his own terms. He makes a mistake which he thought, in the abstract, he thought he was prepared to pay that price. He hadn't put it to himself, of course, in exactly those terms. But in effect, he was saying to himself, look, I don't care what the personal repercussions of this edict are. It's the right thing to do. It's important for the safety of the state. And let the personal repercussions for me be what they may be. I don't care. My duty is to preserve the state. And in saying that, he, as I say, misunderstands his own nature, because in fact he does care, like most people. He really does care about personal relations. So that's another aspect of his cognitive failure, his failure to understand himself. And that, of course, is so often the case in tragedy, that the great tragic heroes fail to understand themselves. And I'm going to say the same about Antigone, indeed. So let's move on to her. Why does she act as she does in flouting Creon's ban and burying Polynices? Well, her ostensible reason, the one she gives to him, is that the action is required by what she calls the unwritten and unfailing statutes of heaven. That's at line 454. So that the idea is that as a relative, as Polynices' sister, she has an obligation to bury him. And a lot of critics have, as it were, taken this as the last word on the matter. If we want to know why Antigone acts as she does, well, let's hear what she has to say. Let's hear what reason she gives. And that is the reason she gives. And so quite a few readers, critics, say, well, that's that. That's why she acts. And many readers, historically particularly, have revered her as a kind of pagan saint because of the nature of her sacrifice, because of her martyrdom for this high principle. Thomas de Quincey called her the Holy Antigone. So she's often been placed on a pedestal, as it were, as a kind of pagan saint for acting in this very idealistic way. But it seems to me that the play does not support that reading, and that it's much too naive, and that there are plenty of indications in the play that her real motives are different. Her real motives have got nothing to do with the unfailing and unwritten statutes of heaven. She's not acting for any such high idealistic reason at all. Her motives are much more personal than that. And why do I say that? Well, there's one very crucial indication, it seems to me, that her own statement of her motives can't be right. And that is her treatment of Ismene. Initially, of course, she seeks her sister's help. But when Ismene refuses to give her help, Antigone turns against her and reviles her and is scornful of her, behaves arrogantly towards her. And then in the scene where Ismene wants to participate, as it were, in the crime, claims to have helped Antigone bury the body and wants to share the death penalty with Antigone, Antigone rejects this scornfully. And she rejects it on the grounds, it would seem, that she doesn't want anyone else sharing her glory, sharing her honour. Ismene didn't help her, that's the fact. So she's got no right to claim that she did. Antigone did it all. She buried Polynices, twice indeed. So she took all the risks. She incurred the death penalty, and she alone should undergo it. And it's a thing of glory for her to do it. She seeks martyrdom. So that she doesn't want anyone sharing that and diluting the glory. And that seems, from the scene in which she refuses Ismene's help, to be her motivation. And she's very bitter and scornful in her rejection of Ismene's proffer of companionship, because that's basically what it is. Ismene wants to die with Antigone as an act of companionship. And as I say, Antigone refuses that offer in very scornful terms, and that, it seems to me, gives the lie to her own statement of her motives, because if her motives really were the ones that she offers Creon, the preservation of the unfailing and unwritten statutes of heaven. In other words, if the point were simply, look, Polynices must be buried, that is what the law of the gods requires, then there would be no reason for her to refuse Ismene's offer, and there would be no reason for Antigone to treat Ismene in the unpleasant way that she does. Some critics, for example, Bonnie Honig, who produces a very interesting feminist critique of the Antigone, she thinks that in that scene, I mean, she actually thinks that Ismene performed one of the burials, and she thinks that in the scene where Antigone rejects Ismene's offer of help, Antigone is doing it for her sister's sake in order to save her life. And it's a kind of ruse to mislead Creon. The thinking would be, well, in order to persuade Creon not to condemn Ismene as well, I'll have to treat Ismene in this apparently scornful way and mock her, put a huge distance between her and me, so that Creon separates us and just punishes me, doesn't punish Ismene. So that's Honig's interpretation. It seems to me, I mean, that's interesting, but I can't see any evidence for it actually in the text. It seems to me quite a stretch to interpret Antigone's words to Ismene as insincere, as a front, in order to protect her sister, which is how Honig interprets her words. So Bonnie Honig interprets Antigone as engaging in a kind of subtle sorority, which looks as though it's not sisterly at all, but underneath is. However, I must say I find that implausible. I think that the surface reading of the text is the right one, in which Antigone really does mean to crush Ismene and is indeed as scornful as she seems of Ismene's offer. And the explanation for that is that she wants the glory for herself. So that her motive is a selfish one, in effect. It's not the unselfish one of trying to ensure that the statutes of the gods are preserved. Now, I said a moment ago that Antigone seeks martyrdom, and I didn't expand on that at the time, but let's do so now. It seems to me clear that she has a death wish in the play. In fact, she tells us in lines 559 to 60 that she has long wished to die. And in effect, I think she is somebody looking for a cause to die for. She's a rebel looking for a cause. She is somebody who starts the play in despair because of the appalling history of the House of Oedipus. And the fact that Creon produces this edict gives her an excellent excuse to defy him and to seek death. And I think that's really what she's looking for. One indication of that is that in her final speech, where she tries to produce a justification of her action, she produces very curious reasoning, not consistent with the reasons that she gave before, and not terribly plausible either. In fact, her reasoning is so odd that a number of critics have thought that the speech can't be genuine, that it must be an interpolation by an actor. And we know that interpolations did occur, and in this particular case it's not that implausible in the sense that, as I mentioned a moment ago, Antigone's part is actually quite small in the play. She doesn't have that many lines, even though the play is named after her and she is in some sense the most important figure in it. Her part is relatively small in proportion to its importance, so that it's not entirely implausible that at some stage an actor or a theatre troupe might have thought, well, we need to beef this part up a bit, so let's give Antigone a long speech before she dies. And then they, as it were, made a bit of a mess of it because the reasons that she produces are not convincing at all and don't seem to fit with the reasons he was giving before or with what we take her character to be. However, I think probably the orthodox view at the moment among scholars and critics is that the speech is genuine, or at least that there's no really very good reason to suppose otherwise. And my view is that the speech actually fits perfectly with her character. The speech demonstrates, it shows her engaging in justifications for her actions, which don't add up, which don't make sense, and don't fit with what she said before. And that fact coheres perfectly with an interpretation of her character as somebody who is a rebel looking for a cause, who's looking for a cause to die for, and who's sort of grasping at any reasons that present themselves. So she starts off with the unwritten and unfailing statutes of heaven, but then later on she forgets that and thinks of some other reasons why it's the right thing to do. And basically she's looking for justifications and grabbing anything that she thinks will serve. And there's a particular reason why she does that at that stage in the play, I think, because she's losing her grip on whether she really is doing the right thing. I think it's clear, although she's very defiant early on in the play and is absolutely certain that it is right to bury Polynices and right to incur the death penalty as a result, and in any case she's long wanted to die, so fine, when the end approaches, it's quite clear that she becomes much less certain about whether she's doing the right thing, and that her struggle to find justification in the long speech before her death is a symptom of that. She's losing her grip on why this is such a good idea after all, and so she's trying to find cogent reasons to shore up her defence. But in the more lyrical passages towards the end, she starts mourning her own death in a way that she never did before. And the way she mourns for it is in terms of traditional categories of Greek thought, like the fact that she's going to her death unwed, without any children, without a husband. These are things that a Greek audience of the time would have regarded as deeply unnatural and deeply tragic for a girl of her age and status. She's an aristocrat. Or her audience would have expected her to marry into a suitable aristocratic family and oversee that domestic outfit. Well, she's not doing that. She's not following that traditional pattern. And initially in the play, she doesn't care about that. She scorns all of that. It's as though that doesn't count for her at all. What matters is that she should do the right thing by the laws of heaven. Not that she should, as it were, be a good Athenian girl or a good Theban girl and follow in the standard pattern of that kind of life. But towards the end of her life, as she approaches death, it appears that she starts to change her mind on that point, and she starts to mourn her death as the death of an unwed girl. So as the death of somebody who has not achieved what she should have achieved, what she now thinks, along with most of the audience, she should have achieved. So it seems to me that Antigone, towards the end, starts to feel that she's making a mistake, that she has made a mistake in confronting Creon over this issue. And again, as with Creon himself, the failure of understanding, it seems to me, is a failure of understanding of her own nature. She doesn't understand herself until it's too late. As the end approaches, she realizes that what the standard pattern of life for her would have been in the expectation of her community, that's to say, to marry and oversee a large domestic outfit as an aristocrat, she begins to see that that is actually what she wanted. That was the thing that answered to her real nature, rather than this defiant act, quasi-political act, as it seems, and is misinterpreted by Creon as being, in which she defies Creon's edict and buries the body and so incurs the death penalty. There's one point at which the chorus praise her and compare her to Niobe. They praise her great sacrifice and the honour of it. And she responds by thinking that they're mocking her, whereas in fact they're simply doing what they took her motives to be. They're simply embellishing and praising what they understood her motives to be, namely the glory of burying her brother and preserving the unwritten laws of heaven, even at the cost of her own life. And so in thinking that they're mocking her, we see that she has now become dissociated from her former apparent motives, the motives that she offered. And indeed, in one of her lines, this is 871, she regrets the fact that she's speaking to the dead Polynices, as it were, in her imagination, and she says, "In dying you have slain me while I was still alive." And this is now a matter for regret. She's regretting that he has done this, in effect. Whereas before, at the beginning of the play, that's precisely, of course, what she wanted. She wanted to be among the dead with her dead brother. She was happy, in effect, to be slain by him when she buried the body and incurred the death penalty. At that point, she had a death wish. She yearned to be with her brother in the underworld. But now, when the end approaches, it seems that all of that crumbles, all of that idealism crumbles away, swept away by the reality of approaching death. And now she regrets the fact that she is, in effect, going to be marrying Hades, going to be marrying the god of the underworld, rather than engaging in an ordinary Theban wedding such as would normally have been expected of her and somebody in her position. So both the main protagonists, Creon and Antigone, are confused about themselves and their own motives. They are both prey to self-delusion. They both fail to understand the deepest springs of their own actions. And the reason why the last speech has been found so uncomfortable by many critics is that they were expecting more of what we had earlier. So earlier we had this very idealistic justification of her action. And in her final speech, you might expect a more formal presentation of that. So a piece of moral philosophy, in other words, closely and cogently reasoned. Whereas in fact, what we get is a piece of rationalization rather than a piece of reasoning. That's to say, something that is basically an attempt to shore up a position any way at all by finding any reasons at all, no matter how absurd or uncogent they are. And that's what we get from her with her justification that there's a difference between burying a brother and burying a husband or child. We have this extraordinary passage in which she says she wouldn't have undertaken the action for a dead husband or a dead child, but a brother is different, and her reasoning there is absurd and would appear absurd to the audience of the time. So we get a desperate and ill-conceived piece of rationalisation rather than a closely reasoned argument. But it does what drama is supposed to do. That's to say, it discloses character, it reveals her character. It reveals her as somebody who doesn't actually believe in the ideology that she has purported to be serving. It doesn't actually make sense for her. It doesn't make sense for her because she's following it so far that she ends up negating her own yearnings and aspirations, her own deepest needs. So as the end approaches, Antigone gets cold feet, as one might put it, loses her grip of her motivation, and it comes to seem to her that she's making a mistake. I think we can't go much further than that in ascribing any very high degree of understanding to her towards the end. So, for example, Martha Nussbaum says that Antigone comes to see that the service of the dead requires a city, that her own religious aims cannot be fulfilled without civic institutions, end of quote. So, in other words, she comes to see Creon's point of view that the survival and integrity of the city is a value in its own right. It seems to me that goes a bit far. I don't think she gets as far as that in her reasoning. That's certainly something the audience comes to see. That is an aspect of the play. But it seems to me that the portrayal of Antigone doesn't show her reaching a very high level of understanding towards the end. She hasn't got that far. She loses grip of the motivations that she had, but she doesn't get as far as supplanting her former ideology with a new ideology. That's why the end is so desperately tragic and so moving, as we see somebody going to her death without really understanding what's going on in the end, and no longer sure that she's doing the right thing. And towards the end, she feels as though the gods have deserted her. So in lines 921 to 4, she almost accuses the gods of betraying her. And it's easy to read these lines or hear them spoken on stage without really registering them and thinking how strange they are actually in context, because one should be asking, I think, well, why does Antigone feel that in allowing her to go to her death, the gods have betrayed her? I mean, that wasn't the way she thought about it at the beginning. Again, she's shifted substantially from her initial position. Her initial position was that she was upholding the statutes of the gods by burying her brother. She was incurring the death penalty, but that was fine because her life was not worth living anyway. She was happy to go to her death for this cause. So at that stage, she didn't think that there was any question that the gods would betray her if they allowed her to go to her death. That's exactly what she was expecting. But now she takes a much more natural position, I suggest, of feeling that she is being betrayed, that the gods should have preserved her life, even though that would be at the cost of the martyrdom that she originally sought. You know, I mean, put it in sort of cruder terms, if somebody seeks martyrdom, you don't expect that person to turn around just before the end and say, well, hold on, why am I not being rescued here? Why am I having to go to my death? Why aren't the gods doing something about this and saving me? No, the martyr sought martyrdom. That was the deal, so to speak. It was because the death penalty was imposed for breach of the edict that the action of burying the body was such a brave and high act in Antigone's eyes and indeed in the chorus's eyes. The martyrdom was the other side of the coin, if you like. It was part of the glory of the act. So in turning round towards the end and saying, well, actually, I don't want this martyrdom. I want to be saved. I want to be rescued. She's disavowing her original motives. And she's in effect saying that the glory of the act no longer counts for her. So that's another aspect, I think, in which her motivation crumbles towards the end. And she loses grip of why she's doing what she's doing and why she really does have to go to her death. And as you see, my interpretation of the play is a purely secular one. I've hardly mentioned the gods at all, except as figures whom the characters themselves invoke. So both Creon and Antigone and Tiresias, obviously, these figures, these characters in the play invoke the gods, they refer to them. But the gods don't seem to take any part in the action. There's no point at which they clearly intervene. It's not clear that they exist as far as the play is concerned. They're there, as it were, as objects of worship. And indeed, it's an important point that Polynices, in invading Thebes, was threatening an act of sacrilege against his native gods. That's part of what makes him a traitor. And Antigone takes herself initially to be acting on behalf of the gods, but the gods don't seem to register, don't seem to do anything, don't seem to be present in any way. And I think it's very like many other tragedies in that respect. The closest analogy, I think, in the tradition is King Lear, where again, you find lots of characters in King Lear invoking the gods or invoking God. The topic comes up a lot in the discourse of the characters, but there's no sign that there is a god or gods there doing anything. There's no intervention in the story by any supernatural force. So it seems to me this again is an aspect of the point that I was talking about earlier, that these tragedies can be interpreted in a secular way. Although the figures themselves invoke the gods, we as critics, don't need to invoke the gods ourselves in order to explain the action. Everything unfolds in purely human terms. So again, as with the Oedipus, I think it's wrong to think of the play as in any sense a tragedy of fate or a tragedy in which human beings are shown to be puppets of divine or at any rate superior forces. No, they have their fates in their own hands, Creon and Antigone. and they play their cards badly. They have tragic flaws, and these lead them into error, cognitive errors, I think. They misunderstand themselves, they misunderstand the nature of the situation they're in, and it's because these factors combine in the way that they do that catastrophe results. But there's nothing suggesting that it was all inevitable, or that the gods brought it about, or that fate brought it about. It could all have been avoided. It's a purely human tragedy, I think. Well, I'll stop there just to remind you, as I've done once or twice or during the course of the lecture, and as I did at the beginning, that all this is highly controversial. Just about everything I've said, apart from the opening description of the play, would be disputed by some critic or other. So that's my view, that's my take, but you need to think about it yourselves and look at the evidence, as I say, look at what the critics say, and make up your own minds about what's really going on in this play.